Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Misha Tate, and you're listening to Carson's Corner.
This is Stitch Duran, and you're listening to Carson's Corner. Make sure you stay tuned in.
This is Justin Ray Harvey, Frank Duke's student. You're listening to the best of the best shows on the web and beyond. Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
This is Bo, the one-man army Taylor, media darling and Midwest champion of the world. You're listening to the only radio show that's hard-hitting, keeps it real, and does not pull punches. Carson's Corner.
This is the coach, Sean Tompkins, and you're listening to the best in mixed martial arts, Carson's Corner.
Okay, let's go. Yeah, g'day, this is Justin Lawrence calling from my backyard in Australia, mate. You're listening to Bob Carson, the finest investigative journalist in mixed martial arts history. Listen to his show. I love it.
Hey, this is Joey Odessa, and you're listening to me on the Bob Carson Show, the show that lets no words barred give a whole new perspective to no holds barred.
These days, it's not much fun at Bally's and Caesars in Atlantic City. The CEO is playing the corporate greed game, cutting dealers' hours, cutting retirement and health benefits, even breaking the law by refusing to bargain. Yet he paid himself $39 million last year, with plenty of perks.
Place your bet.
When Bally's and Caesars play games with casino dealers, it's not fun for anybody. And everybody loses. That's why the UAW Atlantic City Dealers Union paid for this time.
Once again, this is Carson's Corner, and my name is Bob Carson. I got to tell you something, folks. I have to start the show off with a pat on the back. I really do. I just set up a live stream on Facebook, the OBS, and I forgot that for some reason I didn't have the program downloaded. I had a problem with my computer last couple weeks, and I had to restart the computer at the factory level, and I wiped out all my programs. And within the last 2 minutes, I had to re-download OBS, set it up, and then get the stream key from Facebook just in time for us to be on the air 8:30 here on Eastern Standard Time. And I got it all done because today we have a very, very special show here today. One of my favorite people out there, honestly, in the world. I have so much respect for this guy. I've known him since 2008. I've had him on my program several times before. I actually met him in person when he was commentating on the 2008 Iyama Pit Fighting Show, the one and only Iyama Pit Fighting Show. And he's just, to me, he represents a lot, a lot of the good in the world, personal integrity, discipline, intensity, intelligence, fill in the blank. It's John Peretti. And we're so pleased to have him on the program. It's been a while. It's been about 4 or 5 years since we had him on the program. I just got done reading his book, The Origin of a Species in Mixed Martial Arts. Very, very proud to welcome him back to the program, Mr. John Peretti. John, how are you, man?
Thank you, Bob. I'm very happy to be here. I feel very fortunate to be on your program and look forward to speaking to you.
Absolutely. We look forward to having you. I listened to your interview on Eddie Goldman, and it's fantastic as always. Where are you calling from now? Are you in Texas?
I'm in Houston, Texas.
What are you doing down there besides shooting a lot of guns I see on Facebook?
I'm writing full time. I'm about 500 pages into my novel. I have a children's book coming out. I'm getting ready to try to get into the Fort Bend County's Police Academy to be the oldest person to ever graduate from the academy.
Now, what do you plan to do? I mean, are you going to work as a police officer after the academy? What are your plans from there?
Depends who hires me, but first I have to get through the academy. I'm a retired NYPD, I'm 62 years old.
Yeah, but you're obviously in great shape. You've kept in great shape over the years. Your fighting ability, everything, knowledge, cross training of different martial arts is second to none. So, I think you'll be able to make history, no problem.
Yeah, again.
Yeah. Well, listen, John. I really mean that too. I mean, I think. Listen, man, you're a specimen. You're a guy that, even to this day, it's like, Peretti was always very, very intriguing because you're still, I think you could beat a lot of these guys that you see now in MMA and whatnot, and some of these so-called, karate guys and whatnot. So, I mean, that's one of the most intriguing things about you is your physical prowess. Definitely. Because I was reading in your book, and we're going to get into a lot of this stuff, and this doesn't surprise me. Like, I think earlier on in the book, somebody was quoted as saying that they actually saw you take a can of bear spray in the face, and you kind of just kind of shuck it off out there, I think, when you were out in the West Coast or something like that.
I did not shake it off. I mean, it was very humbling. I had picked my son up from school. One thing you realize about California, unlike New York, is that when you are down and you are wounded, no one will help you.
Really?
Yes.
And it's not like that in other parts. Like if this had happened in the city, why do you think that is?
L.A. is a very strange place. It's a bunch of non-participants. It's a giant civilian population, where everyone likes to look the other way. In New York, they've seen everything before, but someone will help you if you're on the ground throwing up and there's fluid pouring out of your orifices from a punctured 16-ounce can of bear mace right in your face, about an inch from my face.
Yeah.
But and I had to pick my son up from school, and then I had to go pick my other son up from school, and my son actually got sick. I couldn't see when I was driving. I had to pull over, and it was an ordeal. I was burning. My skin was on fire for days, and when I would touch somebody, it was like that comic book hero, with a torch or whatever, and touch somebody, and I would leave a red handprint on them. I'm not joking.
Wow. But how did that, I think you explained, but how did that happen actually in the first place?
So I was driving my wife's BMW and I had it stashed underneath her driver's seat, like in the, where the meridian is, the shift lever console. And so I leaned over to unlock the door, or no, to move the seat back for my son so he could get in, my little son Enzo. Yeah. And I moved the seat back. And as I moved the seat back, the way it slides on a rail with a motor, and the seat rails punctured the can, compressed it and punctured it, and it blew up like an inch from my face. The whole can exploded into my face and eyes. So I rolled out of the car on the passenger side. I was in the waiting line to pick up my son at school with all the little, monitor people and all the little volunteers and the teachers, everyone which knew me, and they all just ignored me.
Jeez. Well, it's harrowing and very unfortunate at the same time there. But, I mean, it's just one of the many, many anecdotes that I kind of, just for some reason, I kind of just stuck out in my head while I was reading. And, I mean, you go on to tell a lot of what happened and some of your injuries and whatnot. But before maybe we get into some of that stuff, I mean, you talk about, obviously, some of the concussions, and you've mentioned this, on this program before, that you've suffered. How are you getting along with those things right now?
It's day by day. I struggle. My back got broken twice, and I have a spondylo, and it's cutting off a lot of circulation to my legs. I'm running. I broke the 10-minute mile, so I'm happy about that. But I'm losing my ability to feel my feet, and my legs intermittently are gone. So it's pretty difficult. I'm still front squatting. I'm still trying to train through it. But eventually I'm going to have one of my vertebrae is see-through, and I'm going to have it, repaired in some new way. They have some kind of methodology that's at this moment unsound, but hopefully soon it'll change. The concussive things I've dealt with, Parkinson's syndrome, that's gone. I've repaired myself in all kinds of ways. I'm very much into Wim Hof now. He's the ice man, and I'm doing ice baths 5 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
And that's helped me tremendously. I recently was training in California with Sam Basco, I popped a rib. I healed through a broken rib, cracked the rib, healed through that within 10 weeks, pretty unprecedented for a man my age. I feel okay. Every day is different, and I'm not sure what I'm going to get. I'm working really hard. I work very hard on myself and continue to endeavor to persevere. No pun intended.
Well, we've mentioned it before. You've seen a lot of physical activity in your life, with being an active competitor, high-level training partner, and some of the things that you've done. What was it from as far as your concussive history? Did it start at the time where you were kickboxing or hard sparring?
Earlier.
Some kind of combination of both? Yeah.
Earlier, I went from taekwondo competitions where Koreans won in Korean tournaments. I won't mention the tournaments, but the national championships. I was put up against, for the grand championships, I was put up against heavyweights. I mentioned that in my book that Bob Meyerowitz would have probably enjoyed that idea. Of no weight classes as a reward for winning the lightweights, and then I became a kickboxer, and then felt really good about that, but started getting dropped. And my father said, he'd go to tournaments and watch me, full contact tournaments, and he'd go and watch me and go, yeah, you're getting pretty beat up in there, and I'm making a lot of money, you're getting pretty beat up, and you wait, you're gonna pay. And he was right, I paid, and I am paying. I have felt worse mentally. I can hear my speech patterns, and they're improving. Once you have awareness of something that you do, it's possible to repair. I figured that out, and I feel pretty good about that. But, yeah, I took a lot of beatings and a lot of blows and got knocked out a bunch of times. There's a great story in there, what happened in the second round. And all these things are true, just creating mixed martial arts in America, I took beatings from people. Zenobia broke my back. Everybody, had their hand in twisting my neck. Boss Rutten used to laugh at me because I used to do neck work constantly. I had an 18.5-inch neck at 180 pounds. I worked my neck a lot. It was important for me to protect my neck, and now it's a popcorn circus. I look left, and it cracks and snaps. I look right, it cracks and snaps. My X-rays are ugly. So, you know, in terms of the cognitive function, I'm doing pretty well. And I feel pretty good about it. Physically, you know, it's a rough road, but I think I can repair other things also. I'm not a quitter.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and you've studied across many disciplines, you know, likely as much as any other single individual on the planet. If you had to pass along any advice about training and competing and staying injury-free, especially from something as devastating as concussions can be, what would it be?
Can you repeat that?
If you were to pass along advice as far as training and competing and staying injury-free, what would it be to people that are looking to get into, you know, any type of combat sport?
Well, you know, I have mixed feelings. Preparedness would be nice, but since everyone is incredibly ignorant about the origins of it, they're also ignorant about the possibility of training through something like this. You know, I've put in years and years and years, and still made tremendous mistakes. Looking back, I would have made less mistakes because that hindsight, you know, is pretty crystal clear. What I'd like to say is that, you know, you cannot do this because your dad, you know, wanted to be a fighter and wasn't and was a civilian. It's not like soccer, you know. Your mom can't drive you back and forth, you know, to your little Taekwondo episodes, you know, biweekly. You have to be really careful who you pick to be your mentor. See, I never really put much stock in any individual. You know, I had heroes, you know, but I never put much stock into individuals because, you know, I was always looking around, you know, trying to be an octopus and taking what was good from some and then, you know, disregarding it and then keeping stuff in my pocket for years and not using it. And, you know, until I built the person that I wanted to be, who, as Frank Shamrock gets quoted in the book, who wanted to be the best fighter in the world.
You know, I wanted to kind of pick your brain about some of the issues that relate to present in mixed martial arts, because I know that you don't watch the UFC. I know that the last time you saw the UFC, you were in Mexico, and you had to turn it off. You were disgusted by the lack of technique and so on and so forth. But there was a recent female fight.
That's not true. It's not. I'm sorry, Bob. That's not true. I walked into a bar. I was in hospital in Tijuana, being treated for some anomalies in my, you know, body. But I walked into the bar and I and this fight came on and started, and I counted 18 unanswered blows with the referee just staring, and I was immediately disgusted and had to leave. So, you know, it always comes down to bad refereeing for me. And if you can see, you know, it's a big problem. It's a detriment. You know, I always could see really well, and, you know, and people didn't like what I said, you know, because I could see it happen before it happened. But I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah, no, and your point still, I mean, it still is relevant today, obviously, with the refereeing being a major problem, judging being a major problem, and nobody seems to have a solution on it. But, you know, when it comes to there was a fight between Jessica Andrade and Rose Namajunas, a UFC fight, women's strawweight fight, where Andrade dropped Namajunas on her head. And this was polarizing, you know, amongst fans because it was considered a head spike, which is legal under the unified rules. Big John McCarthy clarified that spiking moves are only considered ones where opponents are driven headfirst vertically to the mat, like a pro wrestling pile driver. You know, which is something that excludes the vast majority of headfirst takedowns in practice. What are your thoughts on spiking as far as the definition provided? I mean, do you think that those type of techniques should be outlawed, or you know, certain type of slam should be outlawed just in the interest of fighter safety?
Yes and no. I'm not going to criticize John McCarthy. I've criticized him enough in my lifetime. What I am going to say is that, you know, there probably are deviations and angles of dissent which you know, are less harmful than others. I didn't see what you're talking about. However, that said, I will say that, you know, what you don't want to do is get picked up and turned and put a half turn on you and dump you on your spine, on your skull, because, you know, even in a collision only sport, you know, like football, you're still gonna, your neck is still going to break. I don't think that's good for the sport, although this sport has devolved, you know, into something I have no idea what it is anymore. But I can't say that that's got to be good for anybody. And anybody that's, you know, living in bodies, like these guys don't even, girls and guys, don't even know, you know, what they're up against later on in life, and how difficult life can get. You have no concept of what it's like to have a swollen brainstem, you know, to have encephalitis, to have to urinate chunks of kidney. To live, I broke my right hand 28 times. To live in the remnants of disfigurement. I, up until probably 15 years ago, I still had 3 human teeth in my left shin.
Wow.
You know, you just don't understand what it's like to get older as a pugilist. You know, and especially in a sport which I think I helped create. I certainly coined it. You just don't understand until it starts to happen. And when it happens, the problem, Bob, is that you're not really there when it happens.
Right.
So you're almost looking back on it as it's happening. So it's in real time, and you're paying the price, but you can't talk to people about that who don't understand it. And I retired so many fighters who had taken too many shots, and as soon as I quit the sport, they all came back.
Yeah, and we're seeing them. I mean, I'm sure we're probably seeing some of them today that are fighting. I mean, that shouldn't be. That can go to commission. They can commission shop, and you know, get a fight. Yeah, where they shouldn't be, and it's really a shame. And you're right; they're paying the price now. You know, we're hearing even the MMA fighters, Bobolo, Hanato Sobral just came out and described the myriad of symptoms that he's having that are just absolutely frightening. I mean, look at Gary Goodridge, for example. You know, other fighters that, you know, down the road are really, really paying a price.
I talk to people, I still talk to people a lot, people that didn't even like me when I was doing my job for them. I talk to them a lot. And she is bad, you know, and I was a precursor to the curve. So, in other words, like I was out there doing that from 17, 18 years old in rings in Long Island, New York. I was going from school to school at night, you know, fighting anybody in any school, anytime, anywhere. And then when, you know, I lived in Chinatown in New York City and studied with, you know, Stephen Ang and the great Stephen Gorick in Wing Chun, and put my legs away for a while. And then went to California to be with Jean LaBelle, you know, to put my hands and legs away for a while and become a true grappler. In every sense of the word, only to start a sport like extreme fighting with Donald Zuckerman, where, you know, you could get your ass handed to you trying to get a straight armbar or a go-behind choke on somebody, unlike the Ultimate Fighting Championship, where your cousin in his pajamas could beat any bodybuilder in the ring or octagon.
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely. One fighting championship in Asia has a no suplex rule, which seems to be somewhat arbitrarily enforced and somewhat vaguely defined, which is also kind of a general criticism of the promotion's attitude to rules. I know that we've spoken about the anvil effect, and you helped me understand a lot about, you know, the way ground punches
actually,
were. Go ahead.
It's actually the anvil factor.
Okay. Yeah, I mean,
I think I coined it on Eddie Goldman's show, but that anvil effect factor is definitive. It was the way that I used to express just what happens with compression against a hard surface like the anvil and the horseshoe and the hammer. You know, if I'm the hammer, the anvil is your head. The anvil is the mat, the ground, and your head is the horseshoe. You're now malleable. It's not like getting hit, you know, in the air where your head moves through space and then your brain compresses against your cranium, you know, in a forward, backwards, or sideward motion. It has room to move on the ground. There's no room to move. So if you're Jeremy Horn and you're dropping fucking elbows on somebody's ear, which is a great technique. I've used it on so many people and imitated him from the beginning. That's the American Sakuraba, Jeremy Horn. If you did that, you're damaging people. So the anvil effect, the anvil, you know, it's real. That's why the horseshoe is malleable. Otherwise, the horseshoe in the air is not malleable.
What about when the head is whipped or dropped against the mat with something like a throw or a slam? I mean, could that potentially be worse than that or comparable? I mean, because of just the amount of force or.
I can talk about it. I talk about it as a historical reference. Here it is. So I'm in like fucking, I don't know, forgive me, Pat Miletich, like, Iowa or somewhere, right? I'm looking at some wrestler. He comes running along across the ring at this guy and snatches him up, does a half turn and slams him on the fucking ground. I never saw anybody do that quite as well as he did, Matt Hughes. And I looked at him and said, man, this guy is incredible, but he's a one show pony. There's got to be somebody who's not going to get taken down and picked up and fucking turned a half turn and slammed on his fucking head. Well, Dennis Hallman, I think proved that, and it was a great match. There it is. You know, what I always warned all my guys in my schools since '74 that the wrestler was easily the most dangerous guy to obstruct and destroy our mission. My mission was always, you know, at a distance, from in your face out to 1,000 yards. That was what my system, Dao Jiu Jitsu Do, was about. But if you're Matt Hughes, you could fuck that system up real easy by scooping me up. And if I could not, you know, drape down to guard and hold an ankle and start working myself into position where I couldn't get ripped off the ground by a guy like that, right? And he's just one example of many. You're fucking dead, excuse me, but you have a new definition of unconscious. So is it more dangerous than the anvil effect? Yeah, because it's less cumulative and it's more instantaneous. But think about it. If somebody like, say, Tank Abbott, you know, on a good day, you know, could actually hold a mount if he even cared to and could actually, you know, lean over like Igor Zinoviev and drop a right hand on your head, well, you know, your cranium is at peril. And you can ask somebody like Ensign Inouye, who doesn't even remember that time in his life because, you know, that's what it's like for us to get knocked unconscious.
Speaking of Tank Abbott, want to give him a shout out. Recently, not too long ago, had a liver transplant and died on the operating table 5 or 6 times.
Well, okay. Yeah. I mean, Tank and I never got along, but that's not the point. You know, I respected his intelligence. I loved his. He's in my book because he had that great gimmick in New Orleans. He showed me where he'd stand on the lay on the ground, and people would stand on his face in shoes. And he had a giant pair of balls on him at times. There's great stories in my book about him. But if you abuse your liver on the level of Tank Abbott abused his liver, don't forget I owned the biggest bodybuilding gym in the United States, Madison Avenue Muscle, starting in 84. Man, these guys have livers the size of your right leg. You know, I mean, there's only so much abuse that thing can take.
Yeah, you're right. And so, I mean, it's not surprising. And his drinking stories are absolutely legendary, no question about it. Can I talk a little bit about the female?
Bob, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That's really what I wasn't talking about is drinking stories because I drank with him. What I was talking about is the radical use of anabolic steroids in the mixed martial arts during my time. And I will tell you that, and on my personal knowledge of it, since I use steroids to go up two weight classes, I will tell you that 95%, provable 95% of all the athletes involved on that high, tippy-top level of the sport that I helped create were on drugs.
Yep.
And you know how I know that? Because the drug dealers, who are also some of the tippy tops, they're all my friends.
Yeah. And you've said that for, I remember.
Let's be clear about that.
Yeah, no, and I remember you saying that. I remember you telling me that 11 years ago, before all the USADA testing and all this. And you know what? It's still like that, too. 95% of these people, probably more now, even with the increased drug testing, USADA, WADA, all the different agencies are still doping. So it hasn't gone anywhere. It really
hasn't.
When you see
a guy, and I'm not going to mention too many names, but you don't have to be a genius to figure this out. When you see a naturally 180-pound guy who's now 245, and you know, and is chasing you through a hotel, screaming and yelling until the Anadrol is coming out of his nose. You have to understand that these guys are all jacked, and they're jacked because that's how they gain shoe size, and that's how their hat size goes up in 2 years, just like in baseball. You know, all of a sudden, guys are wearing size 13 shoes, and they were wearing 11s. I have a pinhead, so you know that I'm not doing that because, you know, I would have a normal size head, you know, if I took enough growth hormone.
Yeah, I know, and the commissions really have a very difficult. They don't really do a good job. When I used to fight too. And when I fought, there was absolutely no drug testing. I fought in shoot fighting, and I fought in mixed martial arts, and I never took a drug test except for my MMA fight, and that was just a joke. And these fighters have it down to a science now. There's microdosing. There's doctors. There's all sorts of ways around the system. You look at someone like T.J. Dillashaw, who's doing EPO right into his bloodstream, injecting it, and you know this is commonplace, and they didn't even it's just absolutely insane. But I wanted to kind of talk about women's MMA, female fighting, and whatnot, because that fight I mentioned earlier drew a lot of outrage from the MMA fans when it came to seeing a woman being knocked out in a vicious way. I know some female fighters complain when they think the referee stoppages for cuts and punches on the ground happen more quickly relative to male fighters. But, is that something you've observed? Would you say that there's a certain amount of double standard when it comes to, you know, reaction from female fights versus male fights?
Well, let me first say that I was a big proponent of women in the ring. and Bob Meyerowitz was dead against me, and for good reason. But I wanted it to go that way in extreme fighting also. But I'm so happy that I didn't do it. I have no basis for judgment on whether fights are stopped earlier, because, you know, I'm a firm believer in the ineptitude of the referee, since they're people that can't tie their shoes, as Gene LaBell says, and they shouldn't be in there to begin with, or the ability for a judge to have his way, and being paid to have his way. So I have never watched what you're asking me, so I have no basis for judgment, and I really can't comment on it, because it would be lying, and I am not going to do that.
No, I appreciate that. You mentioned Frank Shamrock, you mentioned Frank Shamrock and Igor Zinoviev, and you mentioned Igor Zinoviev a lot in the book, how, you know, Igor was just this physical specimen, very intimidating guy, his toughness and all that stuff. And that kind of plays into some of our discussion about the concussions, because, you know, we all saw what happened with Frank and Igor. But going back to that era, John, was there something in particular that era of the UFC had that the current era doesn't, despite the huge value of the company and greater mainstream acceptance we see now?
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely has it. That's my 12-year-old pit bull in the background coughing his lungs out, literally, because he's dying of cancer. Sorry. Yes, of course it of course it did. And I'll describe it for you. First of all, it's eager, like I'm eager to meet you. It's not
right.
Igor. And you know, yes, I trained him for 3 years prior to extreme fighting. It was the Hagler Hearns Leonard of mixed martial arts. It was beautiful. It was Zinoviev, and it was Frank Shamrock, and it was John Lober, and that was the tippy top of the squeeze. Now, if Boss Rutten would have remained at 199, except instead of 199.9 or minus 200, then it would have been a different program for him to be additionalized into that format. But he didn't, because he knew how dangerous the light heavies were and how weak the heavyweight class was. So it was very special because we created champions. Okay, so that was my idea with Extreme Fighting, was to whittle away at everybody and create a pyramidal system of judgment, which was all me, and I made those judgments and create champions. And, you know, I think Meyerowitz is quoted in my book, an inarticulate motherfucker, and I like quoting him, and he says that they just don't have any idea how to make champions. The only champion they created was the guy who I've never met, but White. It takes a different idea, and my idea was very basic. But I'm a perfectionist, and my idea was that it didn't matter who won the fight. That's why I didn't want judges. That's why I didn't have judges in extreme fighting. I don't need judges. If it's a great fight, we'll match them again. You know, if it's a terrible fight, we shelve it. And if it's not a decisive win by submission or knockout, then it's a draw. And it doesn't, you don't need any judges to make that decision, especially because judges, you know, are vulnerable to alternative plans of others. So it was a very different time, and it was a very exciting time. And, you know, it's funny because someone contacted on Facebook, I think they contacted Sam Basco, I can't remember, but and they said, why is the 100 greatest fights on UFC history are 50 of Paredes, and he's not even known as a matchmaker.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, exactly. I never checked those stats, but it's interesting because, A, you know, we didn't have any money in either organization, I didn't have any money. I didn't even have any money in the contenders, and I don't even start to talk about how great that show was. Look at the card. And the first Pro-Am tournament that was ever really run was the Bossford Invitational. That was my show. We didn't have anything, and we created incredible talent and incredible champions and incredible fights. And I'm really proud of what, you know, Donald Zuckerman and I put together. And Donald Zuckerman's, you know, a genius in what he did in his part. And we had the first press release, and Rick Bloom did not write Mixed Martial Arts. I did, and I bought him out. It was a different world because it was a different world. I think it was White that said that never in a million years did those guys, meaning me, and Bob probably, and probably Donald, ever think they were creating a sport. He said that.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a quote. Now,
yeah, well,
how could I not create a sport?
Yeah.
I created the rules. I created the weight classes. I created the gloves with the great Dr. Aswanek. I don't understand how, you know, how things changed the minute I walked in the door into the Ultimate, because Bob and David Isaacs hired me. I couldn't remember David Isaacs' name. I had to ask John McCarthy. He was nice enough to tell me. I don't understand that, those kinds of statements. I don't know what threat, you know, I still hold. I don't understand how threatening I can be. I do have an in-your-face style, but I don't understand how threatening I could be to this day. That, you know, that somebody like, you know, Joe Rogan, who we hired as a backstage commentator, you know, says really nice things about me, and then he says really disparaging things, and I'm not sitting, you know, on one of his chairs to be able to defend myself. I dare to debate anyone, anytime, about any aspect of this, especially if they weren't there.
Well, that's what really gets me is that, and I could speak for other people too that I know. Eddie is another guy too that. It bothers me to a great degree that, as was quoted, you are being redacted from MMA history, and that could not be any more true. It bothers me because a lot of it's politics, a lot of it's money, it's corruption, it's people being fickle, you know. I can't stand when I see an injustice like this, and this happens all the time. You know, in MMA, with the power of the UFC and the power of Dana White and the control, the hegemony that they have over all of the sport and all of the fans and everything like that. And so, you know, that's just really, really frustrating.
What could they possibly debate me about? Could they debate me about, you know, having a paper route in Boston? Sure. While I was a professional fighter? Sure. What were they doing in 1974, you know, when I was fighting? What were they doing when I was creating gloves with Dr. Aswanek? You know, where were these people that say I don't exist? And by the way, he's quoting me on the redacted remark.
Well, you know, I could tell you they weren't involved. Dana White was born in 1969. The Fertittas are a little bit older, and, you know, they were involved with casinos and and you know their father's money and all that stuff. And they took advantage of an opportunity, and they credit those that do service to power that are ultimately in their service, in my opinion, and everything. So there's really nothing to debate. But
there's another factor involved, Bob. There's another factor involved. I'm sorry I stepped on you. There's a lag, by the way, between me and you. Oh, and someone just texted me and said that the link on Facebook is not up.
Yeah, it's.
But I just wanted you to know that.
Yeah, I'm aware. We're on Blog Talk Radio now, and that's where we're coming out. But the Facebook stream is just serving as like a chat room now.
Okay. Anyway, so what people don't know is that, you know, Donald Zucker and I were in contract to buy the Ultimate. And our partners from Florida were they put $250,000 up with Bob, and then they turned it into a loan for Bob, which was a huge mistake that Donald went crazy over. But then the Fertittas stepped in, and because a couple of fighters got together and told them about what I was doing, purchasing. And for a week, I walked around, you know, basically like I owned the place. Then I went on to do Gangs of New York, and I was in Italy, and I got a phone call, and the rest is history.
Yep. Iger, if I'm not mistaken, actually going back to his fight with Frank Shamrock, actually suffered some damage, got a broken collarbone and a concussion and some vertebrae damage. Is that correct to your recollection?
No, it's not correct. It's not
okay.
Correct.
So
he went in with a dislocated shoulder. He also went in with that same dislocated shoulder against Lober. He cracked his clavicle and did not suffer a concussion. Was knocked unconscious. It was an incredible fight. As brief as it was, he was badly coached. I had nothing to do with it, obviously, because I was then neutral. There's a lot of guys in that I interviewed that saw that fight as a fluke. No credit taken away from Mr. Shamrock, Frank, that is. Just the most well-rounded guy out there. That's it. That's what happened.
Another fighter that you discovered, if I'm not mistaken, and you brought into the spotlight, was Paul Jones. Jones was you know, very ahead of his time in terms of certain type of power wrestling into mixed martial arts. He had what people call now MMA wrestling more than a decade before that term was widely used. What is your recollection of Paul Jones?
Shit, I don't know. I don't know. He was a wrestler. I have incredible recollection of other guys, but not a whole lot, you know, on him.
Yeah, he started out in extreme fighting, and
I know who he
Paul
is. I can see his face. Right. I mean, I know who he is. I see his matches. I see, but I mean, like. There's so many strong guys out there. I mean, the strongest guy I ever dealt with on the mat was Mike Van Arsdale. I mean, he was the most humongous tendon strength guy out there, and he might have been natural. I can't say for sure. But he was just beastly. Now, was he as uncoachable as most wrestlers? Yes. Yeah, fifth gear forward. Kind of that Kenny Mundy thing. Very, very difficult to come out of that incredible sport. Sorry?
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. I had some bad background. Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Very difficult to come out of that incredible sport. You know, that sport is a heroic, you know, amazing sport, wrestling. But very hard to come out of that. You know, I worked with world-class wrestlers, and you know most of them that I trained with, and they were pretty easy to submit because they were fourth gear forward, and I was third gear in reverse. That was my style on the mat. So, you know, they walk into a lot of stuff, you know.
John, did you train with fighters that were featured in Battlecade?
All of them.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
Everybody. I trained with everybody. In fact, that's how I found them, you know, by training. You know, I was with LaBelle. You know, I was brought to the Machados by Gene personally. And then I was kicked out of the Machados by the Machados for, you know, as I said before, creating a sport where you could get your ass handed to you trying to get the straight arm bar or the go-behind choke.
Now, this guy, Paul Jones, actually retired in 2000, and he fought Chuck Liddell, and Liddell TK Jones. Was that an outcome that you expected?
Oh, that's a funny word. And a dangerous word, because I didn't care. Once I made the match, and I thought the match was good, and I made a lot of bad matches, Bob, but it was a new sport, and, you know, I'm human. I made some bad matches, Miletich, Burnett, you know, I mean, I did not expect it. But, you know, Chuck loves me. He says very disparaging things about me. Chuck was, he wasn't the quickest guy out there, but he was incredibly well-rounded. And when matched properly, you know, he looked pretty heroic. They proved that, you know, after they took over the sport, you know, because his manager, you know, ran the sport. So, you know, that was opportunistic, in the least.
Well, Chuck Liddell later claimed to Joe Rogan that you personally told him he wouldn't be offered another UFC fight if he didn't strike standing up.
No. What I said, and I said it to a lot of guys, I'm a kicker, right? Is that, you know, I never said that. He's not telling you the truth. You know, he's not told Joe Rogan the truth. But what I meant to say, I don't remember the exact vernacular, but what I said is that I really loved the knockouts, and I really loved legs. And you could ask Maurice Smith. You know, and you know, Maurice Smith, you know, talked about his game plan for Conan, and I thought that was an incredible game plan. You know, like Williams and Coleman. These are game plans by guys who can do things that other guys can't do. Chuck could do things other guys couldn't do. Yeah, he could defend the tackle. Yes, he could do this. He trained with Lewis. I trained Lewis. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, it's not, I was there, you know, to find him, you know, because we were training together. You understand?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's, I wasn't saying, no, you'll never be. What I did say to Chuck, and I don't know why he would want to open this can of worms. I did say a lot of things to Chuck. I said, you know, I talked about his hair, but it was an incestuous time. You know, you're training in the same schools. I'm looking at guys. I'm trying to, you know, get a handle on how I want to make matches. You know, I was at the tippy top of the ladder, and then I jumped off. So, you know, it's not really fair to take it all out of context and say, you know, you said that I wouldn't get another fight. And, well, you know, you're very fortunate. You're a manager now, runs the sport. So you got all the fights that were made for you. You know, again, I'll debate anyone, anytime, anywhere on this subject.
And you were the guy that introduced the world to fighters like Mario Sperry, Kevin Jackson, Conan Silvera, you just mentioned, and many more who are, you know, are highly skilled grapplers. It would seem strange that you would be the one telling someone that they had to fight standing up or dictating anything in terms of what people should do in the cage.
Let's ask, instead of just listening to one guy feeling disparaged, let's ask everyone else. Let's ask every other stand-up fighter if John Ferretti ever said that to them. Or are you just so special now that you can say things like that about yourself? That you were just so magnificent that I could forget about really magnificent fighters, right? And just say that to you. Does that make sense to you, Bob?
Well, what do you think prompted him to make those comments? You know, was it?
I think
was
he
there,
I
there,
think
there,
A,
there
anyway? doesn't like me. Maybe never liked me. He is at the tippy top of the heap. And when you're at the tippy top of the heap, you kind of forget how you got there.
Right.
You know, and that's an interesting evaluation I just made, because it seems like many fighters have selective amnesia as to how they got there. In fact, some were given birth to on third base, and yet they run around saying
right.
they hit a triple.
Right. Yeah. And he's also on the Joe Rogan show, so he could be trying to entertain an audience. I mean, who knows, you know? But
you want to entertain an audience. The next time that he's on the Joe Rogan show, you put me on the Joe Rogan show.
Yep. Well, that won't happen. But I mean, that's, you know. And again, I think that's really a shame. But you know what? Rogan's show is Rogan's show. To me, I think it's a bad representation of the culture and everything wrong with mixed martial arts. Maybe it's just me. I mean, it's very popular. It's very influential. But, you know, that doesn't mean that it's doing us or society any good. Just my
well,
opinion.
Listen,
and whatnot.
I've never watched a Joe Rogan show, so I don't know what you're talking about. However, what I'm trying to say is, here's the question. Is it really Joe Rogan's show? And if it is really Joe Rogan's show, right, what would be the threat of John Ferretti speaking as candidly as I am now on Joe Rogan's show? Where's the threat?
Well, because of, he doesn't own his show, and because the UFC would consider you and the truth is a threat, and so therefore, and because they don't like you, that's why, is that Dana White and some of the powers that be don't like you, so it's easy
why?
To marginalize you.
Dana White has never met me.
Well, you know, listen, he's blocked me on Twitter, and I've never met him as well. I'm pretty sure, you know, I mean, they asked Eddie to participate in the 25th. Anniversary for the UFC, which I was shocked by, and of course Eddie says no way, you guys aren't interested in anything historically accurate, and God bless Eddie for doing that. But that's the way it is now, you know, and that's what I was talking about earlier. It's really really unfortunate, you know, that's the way it is. So, you know, it's not even just Joe Rogan. I mean, yeah.
Well, all I can say. Go ahead. Is I don't really care that's the way it is now. I make no judgments about Joe Rogan. I only know him back in the day as some backstage pencil neck. I don't, and now, you know, I hear he's like a black belt in jiu-jitsu and, you know, he's a tough guy by osmosis. You know, I mean, I don't care about any of that. All I want to talk about is the history of the sport. And the history of the sport predates these OGs by 20 years.
Yeah. Yep. And the problem is that I think is that the UFC thinks that they own the history, and they've bought and paid for the history, if you know what I mean. Which is why, you know, I was going to say it goes beyond Rogan. It's not even just Rogan. It's anybody aside from Eddie and a few other people that want to talk about this and give credit where credit is due. So it's a corrupt market. I think that is fueled by money and what's quote unquote relevant. And you know, it's frustrating. But you know, he, and you know what the real kicker is too, is that Rogan has had people from previous eras of the UFC on his program, if I'm not mistaken. You know, he just wants to definitely avoid a discussion with you, in particular, it seems like.
Why?
Yeah.
Why? What's the threat? That he could be wrong? That he's misrepresented things? That his wallet, you know, is misrepresenting things? That it didn't occur like they say it did? I mean, I don't understand. I mean, Bob Marwitz has no problem, you know, dealing with things like that. You know, I mean, you walk into a job that, you know, he thinks I'm perfect for. They get rid of their matchmaker by proxy. And they all of a sudden they're running an incredible show, you know, with. You know, and it gets better and better, and it gets weight classes, and it gets, you know, gloves, and it gets this, and it gets that, and, you know, and it's becoming this great sport. Of course, it's a big loser in terms of money, and he suffers for it, but he's a charismatic guy, and he's smart, and you know, obviously, you know, I talk about him in the book, and, you know, he has his proper place in history, and I like him. He's got a beautiful wife, and... Man, you know, he's not threatened by me. In fact, you know, he had a hard time working with me. But he's not threatened by me, and he's not threatened by the truth. I'll never understand it. You know, maybe I'm just too old to understand it, you know, too feeble to understand it. But, you know, I'm not done writing about that. I guess, you know, a lot of these people can't read, which is possibly fortunate for them.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't make any sense to me, Bob. You know, what could I possibly say that they wouldn't like?
Were you at all surprised, that Rogan began advocating for things like psychedelic experiences and alternative methods of fitness and such?
Yeah, I know he had Wim Hof on. I like that. I heard that. I don't know anything about psychedelic mushrooms. I did the Make It Jamaica campaign in 1977. I was a photographer and a model on that campaign. And I did mushrooms once, and it was an experience. I don't know anything about that, you know. And in terms of smoking pot, I think it's one of the things that my father was right about. That's why they call it dope. And that's all I know about that stuff, you know. Basically, I'm an old world alcoholic, you know. I'm a white wine guy, you know, that's a problem in itself. You know, but I don't smoke dope, and I don't advocate it or anything. You know, so I don't know anything about it. I got some good Boss Rudin stories about smoking dope, though.
Well, yeah.
Well,
that's what I was going to ask you. Not necessarily with Boss Rudin, but one thing I agree with Rogan on is that he says that 95% of mixed martial artists are potheads and smoke pot. I mean, he say potheads, but use marijuana recreationally.
I know why.
Medicinally, whatever.
I know
right.
why,
well,
because he's in that Brazilian jiu-jitsu community, you know, that whole beach beach goers, you know, Brazilian jiu-jitsu sycophant thing. You know, that's why they're all dopers.
Was it like that when you were around?
Nope, not me. There were no dopers. I mean, we went out and drank beers after training. But no, we were no dopers. We didn't hang around with dopers. Those only the Brazilians were dopers. And, you know, every week somebody else disliked me, so it didn't really matter. You know, like one week it's the wrestlers don't like me, and the next week it's the Brazilians don't like me. Pretty consistently the Brazilians didn't like me, but Carlson Gracie and I were really tight. And then, there were a lot. Alan Goez was a great guy who cared about being well-rounded. Mario Sperry was, you know, 25 Hoist Gracies. There's just, you know, these were great, some great, great, great fighters in the Brazilian jiu-jitsu community, you know. And you'd want to be disparaging, you know. I mean, like Hicks and Gracies, who I couldn't get a match for, you know, wouldn't take a match. He said that Conan and who else did he say? Somebody else, I can't remember off the top of my head. They were blue belts, basically. You know, the guys that I had on my show were all blue belts, but he was the black belt that fought no one. And I know Hicks in a long time. I have tremendous respect for him, although, you know, I never made a match for him because he wouldn't take a match.
Well, yeah.
So, you know, it's great to be, you know, a god, you know, among other gods, you know, in the great chain of being ideology, the gods and the goddesses on top. But who'd you fight? Who'd you fight?
Right.
Oh, I'm sorry. Who did you fight? Anjo. Oh, you fought Anjo. Oh, yeah, I beat Anjo. You know, I mean, it's like, who'd you fight? At least, you know, if you're, you know, if, I don't know, if you're, you know, a great, great, great champion, you know, we know who you fought, right?
Right.
Nobody made the matches, of course, but we still know who you fought, you know, it's pretty easy. We can see who fought who and who fought who and who fought who. You know, there's some other problems with it also. I'll tell you right now, separate from the dope thing, there's other problems. And that's that no one really understands that the day I walk into the UFC, it's now mixed martial arts. It's not no holds barred because I never made a match for no holds barred. I fought in No Holds Barred, but that was 15 years before. But I never made matches for No Holds Barred. It was always a sport to me. It was always mixed martial arts because that's what I wanted. That was my dream from 1974 on, to be the most well-rounded, to have the most well-rounded system.
Right. And you coined the phrase, and this has been documented. You spoke about this at length in your book and others. Have tried to claim that they have coined the phrase John McCarthy, amongst others. And I don't.
It doesn't even, the timelines don't even work, you know. I mean, it just, these guys, like, you know, it's, first of all, Blatnik, you know, God rest his soul, you know, he didn't know anything about martial arts. You know, he was a puppet. He had John McCarthy up his ass, you know, so he could talk. You know, I mean, John McCarthy was a knowledgeable guy in that. You know, he was, you know, a jiu-jitsu guy, Gracie, you know, guy, and a great police officer. And, you know, and I think, you know, a good person. But he didn't coin mixed martial arts. He didn't talk about it in the 80s when I did. There are witnesses to this stuff, you know, there are witnesses at my gym. You know, Madison Avenue Muscle, Leslie Derrick, you know, my first wife, she's the one who actually came up with that name. But, you know, that repetitive MAM, you know, and Madison Avenue Muscle Model Management and all these ideas, they're all, you know, born out of my idea of the mixed martial arts from the 70s.
Right.
You know, Dao Jutsu Do, which is my system, kind of like a mimicry of Jeet Kune Do plus Gene LaBelle, that system was advertised in the Village Voice in the 70s, late 70s, as a mixed martial arts school. That's where we held the tryouts for extreme fighting. That's where we held the auditions for backstage. That's where, you know, it all began in New York City.
Yeah. Well, listen, we went over an hour, which is great. I mean, we had a really, really good conversation. I'm glad because I can go an hour on. I mean, we didn't even touch on a lot of this stuff. Maybe that you know, we can in the future, like Battlecade and the contenders and whatnot. What do you want to leave people with as far as an impression on the book, John? Like, what do you want to get home and drive home to people out there to get people to pick this up?
Well, thank you for that. I really appreciate you saying that. We have to understand, like, I'm a voracious reader my whole life. You know, I was a professor in college for 10 years, starting at 24 to 34. A lot of my world overlaps with other worlds. There's a lot of time links and overlaps in the book. What I try to do is I love literature, and my writing style is different than most. And I want people to understand that, you know, that this thing, this fighting thing, was maybe only one-tenth of my life. I've done a lot of other things on the same level. I enjoy the sports I created. And also, I'm a spear fisherman. I really enjoy doing other sports, but I really also, you know, I'm an artist and I'm a writer. And I want people to understand that well-roundedness, for me, is the most important aspect. And I would like people to read it for that reason, of all the things you don't know about him, you know, this, that, the other. And we don't get to talk about those kinds of things because we get caught up in, you know, in some historical stuff that, you know, that we just did for an hour. And I think that's relevant, but it's not. It's not the end-all, be-all of the book. What do you think?
Yeah. I agree. I absolutely agree. It was very, very interesting reading about your upbringing and you know, how you related to your father and your mother and, you know, the language that you put in there, the different events and stories and everything like that. I mean, you know, in fact, you really, there wasn't a lot. I mean, most of it or a good percentage of it was on that, on your life and your sons and everything like that, as opposed to, you know, just exclusively on MMA and the UFC and whatnot. So, yeah, I totally agree with you, John. And again, I appreciate it. People can check it out. People can get the book on Amazon, I believe, or Lulu.
Lulu has hardcover and softcover now. And Amazon has, I only think, softcover still. It all starts to grow as time goes on. I believe Barnes & Noble's going to be online. It's happening as we speak. It's all beyond me. I'm going to be in Houston, Texas on August 8th, 9th, and 10th. There's a Hall of Fame there, and I'm inducted.
Congratulations.
Thanks. And some really nice people down here. I'm starting to go from school to school. A lot of people don't know who I am when I walk in. Not that they don't recognize me, because they just don't know who I am, which is interesting. Since people created the things they do professionally in their life, these mixed martial artists, it would be nice if they knew the history of what they do and why they do it.
I agree. Couldn't agree more. And listen, best of luck in the police academy.
Thank you.
It would be
absolutely great
to see you. You know, you're training and working very hard, and I'm sure you'll be fine.
It would be a trip. Someone said the other day, I'll leave you on this note, there was a sheriff, Tim Oxley, I've known him for 34 years, and he said the other day, "Oh, my God, you're going to do it." I said, "Yeah, I think so." And he said, "I don't want to be in the Krav Maga class, and I don't want to be in the jiu-jitsu class when you walk in the door."
Hell yeah. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Well, listen, it's another challenge, another chapter. And again, John, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. You've been a good friend over the last 11 years, and I'm sure we'll speak to you down the road, man.
I thank you so much.
We appreciate it, man. Take care, John.
Bye-bye.
All right, that was John Peretti here on Carson's Corner. Yeah, we apologize about the live stream. What happened was, as I said at the beginning of the show, I downloaded OBS because it was wiped off my computer, and I real quickly put up the stream, and I don't know what happened. I got to do some troubleshooting, but we're all live on Blog Talk Radio, of course. And, of course, that was John Peretti, who you just heard here. You know, let me tell you, the reason why people don't know him is because of it goes back to the culture, what I'm talking about, the control, all of these programmed robots. You know, if you mention John Peretti now on the Underground Forum, or if you go to Sherdo or whatever, I don't know what, you know, I got banned from the forums. Just go on any one of these sites, or these MMA sites, or live chat, or whatnot, and they would badmouth him. They would bash him because a lot of these people are programmed to respond to whatever the UFC puts out. I mean, it's the bottom line, and maybe I am too. You know, I still watch the UFC. I still watch every event, even though it's oversaturated and it's predatory, their approach. But I watch it. I do, because I'm a fan, first and foremost. But that's just a crime. It's an absolute crime. And there are many people out there, too, that have contributed to MMA, whether it was the legalization of mixed martial arts, whether it was the sanction of mixed martial arts in New Jersey. And they never get that recognition because, they're not relevant at the time. Because, they're not the hot topic on Dana White's agenda. I mean, it's disgraceful. It really is. But that's why we here at Carson's Corner, we march to our own drummer. We don't really care what they're talking about because, it's propaganda. We don't want the MMA promoters to tell us what's important. We want to decide what's important for ourselves and whatnot. And speaking of what's important, ladies and gentlemen, we've got about 12 minutes left here. I got to tell you that over the weekend, I guess got into a little trouble. I don't know. I got into a wasn't too bad. I've had worse over Twitter and on the forums, but I made a comment on Aspen Ladd's Instagram account or post or whatever. Aspen Ladd, you recall, just beats Jara Eubanks. She won a unanimous decision. A lot of people, including myself, thought that she didn't win that fight. It was a very close fight. One judge had a 30-26 for Aspen Ladd. It was just it was ridiculous. But, okay, nevertheless, she won the fight. She's still undefeated now. I think we're 8-9-0. Okay, and I will say that she really is a very good prospect. She's everything that the UFC wants, I think, she could be a champion one day. There's no question about that. Before she beats Jara, she just destroyed Tanya Evinger, I think, in like a round or so. And then prior to that, she beat Lena Landsberg. She's just on a roll, okay. But one of the things that I've criticized her about, and it doesn't have anything to do with fighting per se. I like to sometimes focus on fighters' personal lives. I like to sort of, I guess, look at things beyond the physical technique and whatnot and the matchups, because I think that gets boring. I really do. I mean, I just, you know, there's only so much you can analyze about somebody's fighting style or matchup and whatnot. And, you know, I followed Aspen on Instagram for a little while now, and she's one of these people that seemingly, just on the surface of things, she doesn't have a lot of independence. You know, she's still very young. I think she's 24, 23, 24, very, very young person. Again, you know, when I was 23, when I was 24, I wasn't independent. I tried to move out of my house when I was 20 and a few times, and it was unsuccessful. But I was dependent on my parents up until 28, okay? And then, you know, 28 is when both my parents died. My parents died within, like, 3 years of each other. And then I became on my own and whatnot. And I got a lot of criticism from people for living with my parents up until I was 28 years old. And in retrospect, they're absolutely right. And when I look at somebody like her, she lives a very, very simple life, which, is, again, it's fine. You know, if it works for her, that's fine. She's obsessed with her dog. She walks her dog. She goes hiking 9-10 miles a day in the California woods, and she trains MMA. And that's great. Again, there's nothing wrong with that, and it's serving her well in terms of her MMA career. But the bigger picture is when you have somebody like that who – you know, and she still lives with her parents. I could tell you, you know, pretty much with certainty that that's the case. And when you have somebody like that, you know, fighting is not going to last forever. You know, John and I talked about the concussions and talked about all the problems and whatnot. And the average UFC fighter probably has a one-year career, okay? Now, this is, you know, part of the the UFC just became public now, or Endeavor just became public, and we're starting to get a lot more information now about the UFC. But the average UFC career is about a year, okay? Now, when you're out of the UFC and you go to Bellator or, you know, one of these other so-called competing organizations, you're not making a lot of money. You know, if you're making money in the UFC, which, you know, athletes and fighters are not making a lot of money in the UFC. In fact, arguably, it's going to get worse now, you know, with the new pay-per-view structure and everything, with the streaming deals and everything, you're making more money than you would at Bellator or any other organizations. There's no question about that. You know, arguably one fighting championship, but, I don't want to really get down into the details here. But, and so, you know, when she's 30 years old or 35 years old, which, you know, may seem like a far time away, but it's going to be pretty much right around the corner. There's going to come a time where you're going to have to get on your own, and you're going to have to become independent, and you're going to have to survive. And, you know, she bought a new car after her fight versus Sajara, and she got a $50,000 bonus. She bought a car. So I said on the Instagram post, I said, did you have a co-signer of that car? And she said, no, you know, I'm going to name my car Bonus and whatnot. Do you have any help from your parents and whatnot? And I started to get flamed. And then somebody representing her mother, I think, I don't know if it was a mother or some sort of guardian, said, you know, Aspen works very hard. She doesn't spend her money, blah, blah, blah. She doesn't need us, blah, blah. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, I don't want to, you know, get into an argument with somebody's mother, you know, or whatnot. I just wanted to make my point. And I did that. You know, you shouldn't be responding to your, you know, protecting your daughter on Instagram. And that's my point, is that, you know, some of these people, and, you know, this may not apply to her, that may apply to her, people that I know in my life and I've seen are coddled by their parents. And you know, they just have they don't know what's in store for them. God forbid if that rug gets pulled from out under your feet. You know, like myself, I could tell you, you know, I'm an underachiever in many ways. You know, I can give you a laundry list of things that I don't do well, and that, you know, I have, and the problems that I have, and that's fine. But one problem I don't have is survival skills. I could survive in any circumstance. I've been surviving on my own, you know, for the last 10 years. I've been homeless. I've lived in trailers. I've lived in cars. fill in the blank. I've lived in parking lots. I haven't had too many jobs, but I don't make a lot of money at my job. I work two jobs. I go to school, and I can survive in any situation. I mean, you know, if you take me now and you put me in the wilderness somewhere, I'll survive. I'm a survivor. Again, I'm not thriving. Nobody's thriving under this disgusting system. But it's something that I learned because I don't have anybody to fall back on, you know. And I really want to help these people out, you know. But they have to hear the truth. Sometimes, especially these female fighters, they have to hear the truth. And they're not going to get the truth from the fake MMA media because, they want to pony up to them. They're going to get the truth from people like me, okay? That's the number one rule here on Carson's Corner, is you have to say whatever comes to mind on Twitter, on Instagram, whatever. You know, even if it's stupid, even if it's offensive, say it. It's better to be honest and hated than to be liked and fake. You know, that's my motto. It's my belief and whatnot. And so I just thought it was funny. It really was. And hopefully, you know, maybe she will. I don't know. You never know. You know, I mean, I will say that Aspen definitely seems like, you know, her family, her siblings are very important. And that's noble. I think that's very, very noble. But, you know, at some point you're going to have to get on your own. Just, you know, as a person, okay? Parents and your loved ones are not going to be around forever. There's just no question about that. All right. That's about it here, folks. I could tell you that we're trying to line up some guests in the future. I'd like to talk to Josh Emmett. Josh Emmett, don't know if he has a fight lined up yet, but Josh Emmett is somebody that I've talked to in the past, not on the show, but I've tried to line him up, and he seems pretty receptive to coming on the program. I think we can have a great interview with him, Team Alpha Male Fighter, because I really, really want to explore his mental toughness. You know, after his fight versus Jeremy Stevens, he was out for 17 months, and he just, you know, looked like it was going to be the end of his career. You know, his whole face was just broken. It was like, you know, the equivalent of him getting into a car accident, you know. And he's come back. He beat Michael Johnson by knockout, and he's back. And that's really, really admirable. And I think he's a top fighter. I really do. So I'd like to interview Josh Emmett. And we'll get some other people, too. Dr. Michael Petro is coming out with an anti-doping article now. I want to get him back on the program, and there's some other people too as well. So we're carrying right along here on Carson's Corner. Yeah, big thanks to John Peretti. I want to tell everybody you can friend me on Facebook. Just type in Bob Carson MMA, facebook.com/BobCarsonMMA, and friend me there. Follow me on Instagram, same handle, instagram.com/BobCarsonMMA. Also follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/BobCarsonMMA. That is twitter.com/BobCarsonMMA. Thanks to everybody out there. Thanks to Sam Bosco and some of the folks who listen in the chat room. I apologize for the problems that we had with the live stream. But we'll get it rectified, and we'll be back at you sometime in the next week or so, folks. Thank you very much. And until next time, ladies and gentlemen, show some respect.